Chapter 9. Osip Emilievich. Thursday, the 17th of May, 1934. I can see, with the benefit of hindsight, that it is a marvelously liberating experience to be arrested. It liberates you from the terror of being arrested. Being liberated from the terror of arrest has a downside. It obliges you to concentrate on lesser terrors. Where your next meal or next cigarette will come from. What would happen if your muse or your erection go absent without leave? How those dear to you will survive if the state, in its infinite wisdom, decides they are more useful as next of kin? What would be the effect on the poet's literary reputation if it was discovered he was terrified of terror? I was focusing on the lesser terrors when the arresting officer delivered my perspiring body to the inner prison in Lubyanka and got someone to sign a receipt for me. I never set eyes on the receipt. But I suppose it was something, a la L. Carroll, akin to received. One Mad Hatter twitching from mercury poisoning or fear of being dispatched to the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns. For the record, let me say that I'd been jailed before, briefly, in the Crimea during the Civil War, detained by Wrangel's white guards rounding up citizens without travel permits or enough cash to bribe their way out of prison. Then freed when the Reds stormed the city and hanged their prisoners from trees on the hill above it. Curiously, I'd even set foot inside the burnt almond Lubyanka once. It had come about this way. My brother Evgeny had been incarcerated in the Lubyanka prison in 1922. Desperate to free him, I'd arranged through a mutual friend to see Nikolai Ivanovich Bukharin, a rising star in the Bolshevik firmament whom Lenin had anointed as the darling of the party. His Bolshevik credentials notwithstanding, Bukharin was a cultivated man, inclined to help artists when he could. Meeting Bukharin in his apartment in the Second House of Soviets, in earlier times called the Metropole Hotel, I'd exposed the absolute innocence of my brother and pleaded with him to intercede. Setting aside the broom he'd been using to swat enormous water bugs, Bukharin had immediately put through a call to the notorious chief of the Cheka, the Pole, Felix Dzerzhinsky, and arranged an appointment for me. I have a vivid memory of the Iron Commissar, as Dzerzhinsky was called, behind his back, it goes without saying. He had a face that looked as if it had been caught in a vice, and a stylish goatee that he kept scratching at when he interviewed me in his cavernous office on one of the Lubyanka's upper floors. When I described the meeting to Bukharin, I elicited a laugh from him by suggesting that Dzerzhinsky's beard may have been infested with lice. Keen to do Bukharin a favor, the Iron Commissar had offered to liberate my brother if I would stand surety for him. Stand surety for him? Holy God! Someone landing from Mars might have mistaken Russia for a civilized country. Within hours, Evgeny was taken from his cell and freed, and I was back browsing the bookstores on Kuznetsky Bridge, a few steps from the Lubyanka, gazing at the heavy granite high-rise that had originally served as the home office of an insurance company, trying to picture what was going on behind the pleats of the large Italian-style curtains that screened the prison windows. It was small comfort to think that now I would find out. Moments after entering Lubyanka, I found myself in a morgue-like room with white tiles on the floor and the walls. Name, forename, patronymic, the warden, a bony man with a shaven head and foul breath, shouted at me. Mandelstam, Osip Emilievich, I shouted back, as if I were responding to a drill sergeant. Why are you shouting? I'm shouting because you're shouting. I am not shouting, the drill sergeant shouted. I am talking in my normal voice. He checked my name against the arrest warrant, then moistening the nib of a pen on his charged tongue, carefully copied it out in longhand on what looked like a bank ledger. Is Mandelstam your real name? I nodded. Without looking up, he shouted, I did not catch the answer to my question. Is Mandelstam your real name or an alias? Real name. Respond in grammatical sentences, not fragments. Fragments are what I shore up against my ruin, I shouted. Say again. Mandelstam is my real name. Occupation. I am a poet. Poet is not a proletarian occupation recognized by Soviet statutes. I had an inspiration. I'm an engineer of men's souls. He didn't seem to recognize the phrase that had been attributed to Stalin in the newspapers.
"What services do you render to the state?" he shouted. "Who pays you for services rendered?"
"I compose poetry, but it's been years since I've been remunerated for this service rendered."
"Remunerated?"
"Compensated. Paid." He scratched the words "intellectual" and "parasite" on the register.
"Date of birth?"
"I was born in the night of January the 2nd and 3rd in the unreliable year of 1890-something, and the centuries surround me with fire," I replied, quoting from one of my poems. The warden raised his eyes and effortlessly delivered a stinging slap across my face.
"You don't take your arrest seriously," he warned.
"I do. I do," I remember insisting through my tears. "I don't expect you to understand, but I am actually relieved to be arrested. It gives me one less thing to worry about."
"Date of birth," the warden shouted in precisely the same disinterested tone.
"The 3rd of January, 1891, I whispered.
"Speak up," he shouted.
"The 3rd of January, 1891.
Place of residence?"
"Herzen House on Nashchokin Street."
The warden looked up again. "Number?"
"I don't remember the number."
I winced in anticipation of another stinging slap.
"Name, relationship of nearest relative to be notified in the likely event of death." "Nadezhda Yakovlevna Mandelstam, wife."
"Remove your suspenders and shoelaces. Empty your pockets."
He snatched my volume of Pushkin and, holding it by the spine, shook it, then dropped it back on the table.
"Stripped to the skin."
When I was standing naked before him, he added the word "Israelite" to the ledger and rang a small bell. A middle-aged woman wearing thick eyeglasses and a white medical smock entered, stage left. While the warden examined every stitch of my clothing, looking no doubt for items on the list posted inside the door, razor blades, nail scissors, pencils, letters or other written material, photographs, medicine of any kind, the medical orderly, if that's what she was, fitted on surgical gloves and methodically searched through the hair on my head. Then she pushed aside my organ and threaded her fingers through my pubic hair, after which, deftly deploying a tongue depressor, she visited the principal orifices of my body in the wrong order. If they had offered me a choice, I would have preferred the humiliation of, "Once, long ago, there was such a poet."
"Why are you trembling?" the warden shouted.
"I am chilled to the bone," I shouted back.
"You were sweating when you arrived."
"I have a built-in thermostat that takes into account my level of fear. Sometimes I sweat. Sometimes I tremble." With a snap of his fingers, the warden signaled for me to dress. The items in my pockets were placed in a cardboard box, and I was instructed to sign the page in the ledger listing what had been confiscated. One internal identity card in the name of Mandelstam, Osip Emilievich. One Moscow residence permit made out to the same name. One cotton handkerchief, frayed at the edges. One box of Komsomolskaya brand safety matches. One half-empty pack of Herzegovina floss. One Odessa dental floss dispenser. One passkey to the front door of Herzen House. One latchkey to our ground floor flat. One vial of prescription sulfur pills for heart palpitation, another of valerian drops to calm nerves and induce sleep, 40 rubles in banknotes, 20 kopecks in loose change. I was issued an army blanket and a small towel and a bar of laundry soap, along with a chinaware soup bowl so out of place in a prison it could only have been part of the elegant table service used by the insurance company for banquets at the turn of the century. Clutching my trousers and my volume of Pushkin in one hand, shuffling along in laceless shoes, I followed a turnkey through the labyrinthine corridors to the cell block at the heart of the Lubyanka. Every 20 or so meters, steel doors clanged open before us, the racket of the gate alerting everyone within earshot that another soul was entering this Soviet purgatorio. Disoriented in the twisting corridors, I penetrated the heart-murmuring terrain of Di Alighieri, half expecting at each turn to come across Virgil washing the stains of hell off my beloved Dante, to hear his glorious infant-like babbling. E consolando, osava l'idioma, che prima i padri e la madre trastulla, favoleggiava con la sua famiglia, de Troiani, de Fiesole e di Roma. I was eventually shoved into a cell illuminated by a blindingly bright electric light suspended from the ceiling. There was a window high in the wall, but it was covered with planks. I shielded my eyes with my volume of Pushkin and made out the two prisoners already in the cell. One was squatting in a corner in what smelled like a puddle of urine and excrement, moaning as he rocked back and forth on his bare feet. The other prisoner, a giant of a man, was sitting on a blanket with his back to the wall.
"I think he is dying," the giant said,
indicating the moaning figure with his chin. He angled his head so that his right ear was turned toward me and said,
"What are you guilty of, comrade?"
I set my belongings on the stone floor, and, sitting down on the folded blanket facing him, covered my nose and mouth with my forearm. "I am guilty of being a poet," I said. "I am guilty of not beating about the bush."
"Poetry doesn't strike me as honest work," the giant said, "in the sense that you don't produce something people can eat or wear. Me, I'm Shotman, Fikrit Trofimovich. He's Sergo. His family name and patronymic are known to God, but not to me."
"Mandelstam, Osip Emilievich," I said.
"Pleased. Fact is, I'm glad to have someone to talk to. Sergo is no longer capable of conversation. I work as a strongman in the circus."
"You don't produce something people eat or wear either."
"I entertain the working class. You entertain the intelligentsia. You can't compare the two. I have a common law wife. She is the tattooed lady in the same circus as me. Her tattoos are art and history and nature and geography all rolled into one. The first time I saw them, I fell into love with her. What about you? Are you married?"
When I said I was, he wanted to know if my wife had any tattoos. When I said no, he tossed his head.
"No matter. She may have other qualities. How did you meet?"
Telling him took my mind off my present predicament. "I first set eyes on Nadezhda, that's her name, in a cabaret in Kiev, called the Junk Shop. I'd been watching her for the better part of an hour. She was bantering with her companions, laughing at their jokes, listening intently to their stories, all the while burning with sensuality. I was overwhelmed by the desire to warm myself at her flame. All I could think to do was ask her for a cigarette. She looked up and smiled and gave me one, and we've been together ever since. Tell me, Fikrit, how long have you been in the Lubyanka?"
"Lost track."
"Do they ever turn the light off?"
"Never."
"How can you sleep with it shining in your eyes all the time?"
"Can't," he said. "That's why they leave it on. If you do doze off, the comrade guard who keeps an eye on us through the peephole will hammer on the door until you wake up. My interrogator, an experienced Czechist with the best interests of his prisoners at heart, says being exhausted helps clear the mind of bourgeois delusions of innocence. If you are here, it's because you are guilty of something. The sooner you identify your crime, the sooner your case will be disposed of."
I looked again at the figure squatting in the corner. "If he is really dying, why don't you summon medical help?" The giant thought my suggestion humorous.
"Medical help? That's a good one. They're the ones making him die."
"Why are they making him die?"
"Because he won't admit guilt."
"And what is he guilty of?"
"Article 58. Anti-Soviet propaganda and counter-revolutionary activity. He is guilty of wrecking. He told me so himself when he was still able to talk. He raised the subject of collectivization in front of Stalin at a public meeting."
Fikrit must have seen I was trembling.
"Not to worry yourself sick, Osip Emilievich. They won't beat you if you admit the truth straight off."
"If he admits he is guilty of wrecking, will they stop beating him?" Fikrit became indignant.
"This is the Soviet Union. Socialist justice and the rule of law always triumph. Once Sergo admits guilt, they will stop the beatings and shoot him."
"Without a trial?"
"There may be a secret trial. Though the law doesn't require that he be present or have access to the evidence against him. So the comrade interrogator told me. As you can see, Sergo is in no shape for a public trial."
"Have you admitted your guilt?"
"At first I didn't. Not because I was trying to fool them into thinking I was innocent, nothing like that. I didn't admit it because I didn't know what I was guilty of."
"Did they beat you?"
"They did. The beatings, along with not being able to sleep.
helped me to see the light. I have confessed to being a member of a backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik conspiracy. When the day comes to overthrow the Bolsheviks, the members of this conspiracy will recognize each other, because we all have distinctive Eiffel Tower stickers on our valises or trunks. The Eiffel Tower, in case you are not familiar with it, is located in Paris, France. To make my personal situation worse, I kept Tsarist loan coupons against the day when, thanks to Trotsky, capitalism is restored and I can cash them in.
If you've admitted your guilt, how come you're still in prison?
Because I was lucky enough to be selected for public trial. They have promised that my common-law wife will be there to see me. I can tell by the suit you're wearing you are a member of the intelligentsia. A poet is the same thing as an intellectual, right? So you probably do not recognize me. I am, excuse me for being the one to say it, famous in Russia for winning the silver medal at the All-European Games in Vienna, Austria in 1932. A picture of me shaking hands with Comrade Stalin at the Kremlin was printed on the front page of Pravda. Comrade Interrogator has promised my picture will be on the front page of Pravda again when I give details of the Trotskyist conspiracy at my trial. Right now, I am memorizing these details. Poor Sergei. If he was really dying, he was doing it by centimeters. His moaning never let up. Even now, when I think back to that cell, I hear Sergei whimpering. I gag at the memory of the stench rising from his tortured body. As for Fikrit, you could tell he was a good-hearted soul. But once he'd recounted his childhood in Azerbaijan and his exploit in Vienna, and his botched knee operation and his life as a circus strongman, we more or less ran out of conversation. When he wasn't summoned for interrogation, he spent endless hours sitting with his back to the stone wall, his large head buried in his large hands, repeating aloud the confession he would deliver at his trial. I caught fragments. That would lead to his ruin. How he'd been recruited in Vienna in 1932, and been given a down payment in United States dollars. How he'd communicated with his handler using a secret code, buried in the dedication inside the cover of an American fitness magazine. How, carried away by his hatred for the new order, he had disfigured Stalin's face tattooed on his upper arm. There was more, a great deal more, but it has long since slipped my mind. I made a stab at keeping track of the passage of time, but this turned out to be a challenge requiring clear-headedness, and thus beyond my capacity. One day blended seamlessly into the next. I believe, though I can't swear to it, that I was taken off for interrogation after I'd spent something like 4 days and four nights in the cell, never sleeping more than a few minutes at a time before the comrade guard, as Fikrit called him, woke me, along with everyone else in the cell block, by slamming a sledgehammer against the metal door. What I am certain of is that they came for me after the evening meal, which consisted of watery soup splashed into our chinaware bowls. A beefy guard turned up at the door of the cell and pointed what looked like a cattle prod at me. Fikrit must have sensed where I was off to, because he offered some last-minute words of advice. I have heard it said that poets are somehow connected with culture. Which means your interrogator will be Comrade Kristoforovich. He specializes in culture criminals like yourself. Find out what you're guilty of and then confess it, Osip Emilievich, and things will go more smooth for you.
I realize now how difficult it is to reconstruct the 14 days I spent in the Lubyanka, given the fact that I was frightened out of my skin even when I managed to doze. Which is to say, my brain was functioning sluggishly. It was as if a shadow of a doubt had lodged in my skull, with the result that I wasn't certain in what order things happened, or whether they happened at all. My state of mind is probably best conveyed by comparing it to the loss of depth perception, something I actually experienced in the months after my arrest. You perceive things with a hazy lucidity, but you aren't sure if they are in front of your nose or several meters away. You wind up not being sure if they are there at all, or fragments of your imagination. To this day, I am haunted by spectral memories that have the graininess of bad dreams, of an open freight elevator rising with excruciating lethargy to a high floor, of brightly illuminated corridors with worn runners that, like the chinaware, looked as if they dated back to the turn of the century when the building served as the headquarters for an insurance company, of a polished brass number 23 on a polished wooden door, of an enormous room with bright spotlights that caused your eyes to smart the moment you crossed the threshold, of the clatter of a typewriter coming from behind a slightly open door, of the distant chiming of the hour from the Kremlin's Spassky Tower, of a blurred figure of a man dressed in some manner of uniform and a leather butcher's apron, gesturing for the guard to leave. I heard the man, who was sitting in front of an enormous photograph of Stalin, introduce himself. Kristoforovich. I see myself shielding my eyes with my palm, then quickly withdrawing it lest he take it for a salute. Mandelstam. Sit. Squinting to protect my eyes from the light, I dropped onto a wooden stool, the front legs of which were shorter than the rear legs, with the result that I had all to do to keep me from sliding off. The interrogator studied me from behind a mountain of folders. Any complaints about your detention? When I didn't respond, he asked, How do you feel? Exhausted. I intended to stop there, but confusing an interrogation with a confessional, I heard myself add, Exhausted and frightened. Let me interrupt my narrative to say that when I have been interviewed, in the years before I was poeticus non grata, the words, the phrases attributed to me when a given article appeared in print were approximative. A journalist has a natural tendency to filter what you say through the prism of his syntax and style, so that what you hear is his voice, not your own. Which makes me aware that the scenes I am reconstructing for you from memory must suffer from the same defect. The words I attribute to others are surely approximative, with the notable exception of what the interrogator Kristoforovich uttered when I admitted to being frightened. Should I live to be 50, I will never forget his reply. As I summon it now, I can still hear his intonation, soft and threatening, like distant thunder that augurs a particularly brutal storm. Here, word for word, is what he told me. It is useful for a poet to experience fear. It can inspire verse. Rest assured you will experience fear in full measure. I was trying to pass this in the hope of finding meanings other than the obvious one when he asked, very quietly, Have you figured out why you are here? I realized, through a film of exhaustion, that I had to tread cautiously. Clinging to the possibility that he didn't know about the Stalin epigram, I started through the minefield. Is it because of something I wrote? Inspired guess, Kristoforovich agreed with a hollow laugh. It could only have been my prose piece, Conversation about Dante. My interrogator removed his green visor and tried to flatten down an unruly tuft of hair. What you wrote on Dante was not subversive, he said. You are familiar with my essay on Dante. I'm familiar with your thesis, that, for Dante, the Inferno is described as if it were a prison. Moistening the ball of his thumb, Kristoforovich leafed through a thick dossier, found the page he was looking for, and began to read lines I had written. All our efforts are directed toward the struggle against the density and darkness of the place. Illuminated shapes cut through it like teeth. As you will come to understand, I'm familiar with every word you ever wrote. After your wife, after the harlot Akhmatova, I am probably the leading Mandelstam scholar in the Soviet Union. If it's not my Dante essay, it must have been a poem that landed me in this inferno. He waited. I grasped that silence was one of the tools of his trade. I attempted to distract him with lines from an old poem, In the Black Velvet of the Soviet Night. He pulled another page from the dossier. Vintage 1920, according to my notes. Try again. Whom will you next kill? What lie will you now invent? My interrogator clearly enjoyed sparring with me. That's from your poem entitled January 1st, 1924. We've known about it since January 2nd, 1924. By then I was breathing with difficulty. The wolfhound century leaps at my throat. My mouth has been twisted by lies. Through the raw light I could make out Kristoforovich sadly shaking his head. You're getting closer in time. That's from 1931. How I'd love to speak my mind. To play the fool. To spit out truth. You're stuck in 1931, though the spirit of that particular poem is closer to the one that landed you on our doorstep. My heart was pounding in my chest as I racked my brain for lines to throw him. As if wearing silent slippers, the starving peasants watch the garden gate but do not touch the chain. You're getting warmer, Mandelstam. May 1933, if I'm not mistaken. You called it Old Crimea when you recited it to your first reader. And then Christophorovich, moving in what appeared to be slow motion, removed a single sheet of paper from the dossier, and, angling it to catch the light, began to read. We live, deaf, to the land beneath us. 10 steps away no one hears our speeches. All we hear is the Kremlin mountaineer, the murderer and peasant slayer. The faint hope that I might somehow come out of this alive plummeted like a shot bird. Quicksand sucked at my feet. I could see his eyes fixed on me over the sheet of paper. Do these lines ring a bell, Mandelstam? When I couldn't bring myself to answer, he flung the juiciest morsels of my epigram in my face. Fingers fat as grubs, cockroach whiskers, a rabble of thin-necked leaders. He delivered the last 2 lines from memory. And every killing is a treat for the broad-chested Ossete. Christophorovich came around to the front of the table. You are said to be skilled at interpreting poems. In your considered opinion, who is this Kremlin mountaineer? Who the broad-chested Ossete? Clutching my trousers at the waistband with fingers that had gone numb, my laceless shoes planted flat on the quicksand and pushing against it to keep myself from sliding off of the stool to certain suffocation, I looked up at the interrogator looming over me. I had difficulty bringing him into focus. I heard him say, "Calm yourself, Mandelstam. You must have known what you were getting into when you composed this seditious poem, when you flaunted it to your first readers." I think I said something along the lines of, "I have gone beyond calm, comrade interrogator, never to return. I am experiencing fear in full measure." "Excellent. This will have the advantage of accelerating the often tedious process of interrogation. The trick is to think of us as collaborators. My job is an exhausting one. If you are questioned all night, bear in mind that I must question you all night. All night, every night, until you not only grovel in guilt, but give me the names of those to whom you read the poem." How is it possible for a cultural criminal like myself to collaborate with a cultural commissar? We can meet on a middle ground. There is no middle ground in an unweeded garden. Stalin himself has decreed that there are only 2 possibilities. Either you are with us, or you are against us. Thinking of Nadenka, I added, I am a great believer in middle grounds. If Stalin had left a sliver of middle ground, I would have jumped at the chance to live out the few years left to me on it. What Stalin said was a figure of speech, a slogan designed to rally the troops to class warfare. Here in the sanctuary of the Lubyanka, there is a middle ground on which you and I can meet, Mandelstam. We Bolsheviks are not brutes bent on destruction for the pleasure of destroying. We are builders. We are attempting what no one has ever before attempted, to construct socialism, and once constructed, use it as a cornerstone to construct communism. War, poverty, inequality, exploitation will vanish from the face of the earth, or at least that part of the earth we preside over. Are you familiar with the work of the dramatist Nikolai Pogodin? In the early 30s, he wrote a brilliant play that sums up who we are and what we're doing. It was called My Friend. Stalin himself has commented favorably on it. The play dramatizes the struggle to build a large factory in a backward peasant country. Pogodin's characters are ordinary workers, overcoming enormous obstacles, performing heroically to construct socialism. We are all of us, from Comrade Stalin on down to the humble Czechist interrogating wreckers in the Lubyanka, ordinary workers, performing heroically, trying to create a state that functions for the good of all its citizens, and not merely the handful of rich capitalist exploiters who own the means of production. Surely you can understand that to succeed at this hallowed project, the first order of business is to protect it from wreckers like you. Christophorovich hit a small bell with the heel of his hand. The guard who had brought me turned up at the door. Think about what I have said, Mandelstam. Tomorrow night we will pick up where we left off. Hopefully we will identify the sliver of middle ground on which we can comfortably collaborate. Here is the second interrogation, or at least, in my imperfect memory, what I think of as the second interrogation. I remember being led again through the long corridors to the door with the number 23 on it. For some reason, Christophorovich was not yet at his post behind the table. I stared at the photograph of Stalin on the wall, half convinced that he would personally interrogate me this time, all the while aware of an animal fear growing inside me like a tumor. Fear of poison, of suffocation, of strangulation, of decapitation. I must have fallen asleep on the stool, because the guard kicked the legs out from under it, sending me sprawling across the parquet floor. With an effort, I crawled back onto the stool. When I looked up, I saw Kristoforovich observing me from behind the table. "Have you searched out the common ground on which the cultural commissar and the cultural criminal can meet?" he inquired. In a delirium of terror, I clutched at a straw. "What you have is an early version of the Stalin epigram. The second stanza was revised. There is no mention of murderer and peasant slayer in the final version." Kristoforovich pushed a blank sheet across the table, along with a fountain pen. He motioned for me to move my stool closer. "Write out the final version of the poem in your own hand," he instructed. My brain was awash with storylines. Had the people who left cigarette ends in our ashtray planted listening devices in the walls of our flat, after all? Had they recorded my reading of the first version to Nadenka and Zinaida? Had they heard me offer to copy it off for Zinaida, so that she could memorize it? Had they arrested her and seized the incriminating evidence before the poor girl could destroy it? Were Nadenka and Zinaida even now cowering in a cell somewhere in the bowels of the Lubyanka? In the bedlam of thoughts and emotions, one thing seemed crystal clear to me. The fact that Kristoforovich possessed the original epigram meant I could no longer save myself. But I still might be able to save Nadenka and Zinaida, along with the others who had heard the epigram. Leaning over the table, I wrote out the lines, including the revised second stanza. "But where there's so much as half a conversation, the Kremlin's mountaineer will get his mention." Kristoforovich snatched the new version from my fingers and read it carefully. He had what can be described as a smug smile on his lips when he finished. "But that changes everything, Mandelstam. Without the murderer and peasant slayer, the whole thing is much more tepid, though we still have to deal with the cockroach whiskers, not to mention the every killing is a treat for the Ossete. Given this change, there may be a ray of hope for you if..." He was a delicate interrogator. One couldn't help but admire his skill as he left the "if" hanging in the air between us. "If," I repeated. He shrugged. "You must absolutely name names, if it is any comfort to you. Rest assured, we know them already. We know to whom you read the poem. We know their various reactions. Still, it will count against you if this evidence comes from us, as opposed to your making a clean breast of things. If you desire to make amends, to cleanse your criminal behavior with collaboration, name names. An individual blessed with a poetic talent has a sacred obligation not to betray that talent," I said. Kristoforovich only smiled. "A person blessed with a poetic talent has a sacred obligation to remain amongst the living and exercise that talent." The interrogation continued on through the night. Kristoforovich coaxed and cajoled and wheedled and threatened. At one point he informed me that Nadenka and Zinaida had been arrested as co-conspirators in a plot to overthrow Stalin and were being interrogated in another part of the Lubyanka. He accused me of egoistically putting their lives in jeopardy, as well as compromising all those to whom I had read the epigram. Exasperated by my refusal to name names, he summoned an enormous Uzbek with a deformed nose, who attached my wrists to irons embedded in the wall. I fainted straight away from fear. When I came awake, the medical orderly was listening to my heartbeat with a stethoscope and shaking her head. "If you don't want him to die on you, I suggest you suspend the questioning and let him sleep a few hours, comrade interrogator." I could make out a rose-gristled dawn bleeding through the window where the Italian curtains didn't overlap when the guard came to fetch me back to my cell. Passing through the last of the steel doors, I reached my cell block. The guard left me for the time it took to get fire for his cigarette from the turnkey. Standing with my back against the wall, where, improbable as this sounds, someone had taped up pages from a magazine with portraits of the generals who defeated Napoleon, I thought I heard a woman whimpering. The sound seeped from under the door of a cell, two cells down from my own. And then, dear God, I distinctly heard Nadenka's voice. She seemed to be trying to comfort another woman. It was a fleeting impression based on intonation more than actual words. But I'd recognize her voice anywhere. Back in my cell, I knelt beside Fikrit and whispered in his good ear, "Have you heard women whimpering?"
"I have," he said. "If I press my good ear to the stone of the wall, I hear my Agrippina crying her heart out. I hear her saying over and over, 'Fikrit, Fikrit, what have you gotten us into?'"
Sergo, when he was still able to talk, warned me about how they play recordings of women's voices to weaken our will to resist. But I no longer resist, and still I hear her whimpering. It is not a recording. There is no doubt about it. Like me, she is a prisoner in the Lubyanka. I crept back to my side of the cell and, coiling my body into a fetal position, fell into a sleep so shallow that the guard's failure to pound on the door woke me every few minutes. I dreamed I was sleepwalking through walls, but became so frightened I would be trapped in a wall that I forced myself awake, or thought I did. I wasn't sure whether I was asleep and dreaming I was awake, or actually awake, when I urinated into the slop jar. The sound of urination, the stench coming from Sergo's corner of the cell, seemed real enough, which suggested I was awake after all. Seeing that both Sergo and Fikrit were sound asleep, I checked to make sure the leather flap was over the peephole in the door, then went across to the wall, meaning to put my ear to it. On an impulse, I shouldered through the wall into the next cell. Two prisoners, one an old man with fine grey hair falling to his collarbones, the other a young, prematurely bald man with a blanket draped across his shoulders, were playing chess on the cement floor, with tiny pieces moulded from scraps of soap.
"Check," the old man declared triumphantly, edging forward a rook with a fingernail.
"Ah," his opponent said, "I didn't anticipate that." I cleared my throat to get their attention. They both raised their eyes.
"Excuse me for interrupting your game," I said. "If you're looking for the women," the young man said, "they're one cell over." And he gestured with a thumb that was missing its nail toward the far wall. I started to thank him, but he had turned back to the game and was concentrating on how to extricate his king. I watched them for a moment, uncertain how I'd gotten into this cell, uncertain how I would get out. Then, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, I walked through the wall he had indicated and found myself in a smaller cell illuminated by a bulb so weak you could see the yellow filament in it. As my eyes became accustomed to the density of the darkness, two illuminated shapes cut through it like teeth. Nadenka and Zinaida were slumbering in each other's arms. Nadenka was wearing the dress she'd had on the night of my arrest. Zinaida was in the off-white mousseline costume she'd worn when we saw her perform in Three Sisters. I sank to my knees next to Nadenka. Sensing a presence, she stirred. Her eyes opened and she gaped at me in fright. I put a finger to her lips to keep her from crying out.
"How in the world did you get here?" she demanded.
I heard myself say, "You won't believe me if I tell you, so I'd better not tell you lest you take me for a mad hatter."
"When were you arrested?"
"During the search of our flat. They found the poems concealed in the teapot. The swine Sergei Petrovich must have betrayed the hiding place. When they discovered they were in my handwriting, they arrested me on the spot."
"And Anna Andreevna?"
"Anna was still in the living room when they took me off. I don't know her fate."
"When was Zinaida arrested?"
"They searched her apartment while she was away at the theatre and found the epigram. The dear girl feels dreadful about not having destroyed it. They turned up at the theatre and arrested her between acts. As there was no understudy present, the performance had to be cancelled."
Nadenka took my hand and pressed the back of it against her cheek, and I could feel the tears streaming from her eyes.
"Oh, Osya, what shall we do?"
With all the commotion, Zinaida was stirring now. She, too, came awake. When she saw it was me, she burst into tears.
"I will never, ever forgive myself for not destroying the epigram," she managed to say between the sobs that racked her body.
Once past the initial emotion of seeing me in her cell, Nadenka, true to character, turned practical.
"Are you being interrogated?" she asked.
Without waiting for a reply, she said, "It must be the one known as Kristoforovich. They say he is the commissar charged with cultural crimes.
Have they tortured you? Are you hurt?"
I told Nadenka how he had read the original version of the epigram, how I'd written out the revised version without the offending stanza that Pasternak had asked me to remove, how it had all come down to my identifying the people who had heard the epigram, something that I had up to now refused to do,
But surely they know who heard the epigram?
Nadenka said.
They will have planted microphones in your walls,
Zinaida whispered.
They will have recorded everything we said.
A terrible thought came to her.
They will have recorded everything we did.
Nadenka turned on her.
If they had planted microphones in the walls, they would have arrested the three of us months ago. They would have swooped down on Herzen House and arrested Mandelstam the morning he read out the epigram to us to nip the thing in the bud. There are no microphones, which means we only need to concoct a story they can swallow.
She reached for my head and, pulling it closer to hers, said fiercely,
Listen to me, Osya. You must give them names. We must be seen to be naive intellectuals who blundered and are ready to make amends. It is our only chance.
How can I implicate Akhmatova? How can I implicate Pasternak and the others?
You say you recited the epigram without warning them what the subject was. You say they all reacted, like Pasternak, with horror. You embroider. Each and every person who heard the epigram was appalled at the idea of maligning the great Stalin. Each and every person tried to talk you into destroying it, that sort of thing.
Nadenka touched her forehead to mine.
You can do it, Osya. You must do it for your own sake, for our sakes. You must give them whatever they want. Nadezhda is right,
Zinaida pleaded.
Please, please cooperate with the authorities so we can get on with our lives.
And so I named names. I was a nervous wreck. It's not every day you walk through walls. And began talking so rapidly, Kristoforovich had trouble keeping up with my confession. He summoned a stenographer and made me start over again. He wanted names. I gave him names.
Nadezhda Yakovlevna,
best friend, comrade in arms, wife, like Mayakovsky, an ardent supporter of cracking eggs in order to make omelets, was the first of 11. How did she react? She came as close as she ever had to throwing me out of the flat. Sheer slander, she cried, insulting to the intelligence of anyone who might hear it, because the entire world knows Stalin as the first among equals, someone who leads by collegiality. Zinaida Zaitseva Antonova, theatre actress, poetry lover, friend, was the second. She was sickened to learn I could sink so low as to spread libel about someone as brilliant and at the same time as modest as Stalin. Pasternak threatened to end our long and close friendship if I didn't destroy this scandalous epigram. As for Akhmatova, I thought she would throw up on our living room floor when she heard it. She insisted it wasn't a poem at all but a polemic, a political argument that was wide of the mark, inasmuch as Stalin had no connection with Ossetia and was universally respected, even by his political opponents, for his sincerity and idealism. Ditto for Sergei Petrovich, whose family name escapes me. Ditto for the six others who had the misfortune to wander onto the middle ground Nadezhda and I had created, only to find themselves the captive audience of a demented poet. All of them, starting with Nadezhda, argued that I shouldn't be wasting my talents, assuming I had any, doing the villainous bidding of wreckers and counter-revolutionaries, that instead I ought to be composing an ode to the glory of Stalin, to his courage during the revolution and the civil war, to his accomplishments as a builder of socialism in one country, to his inspired leadership that is bringing industrialization and collectivization to backward Russia. I see now that they were right, and I was wrong. When I had run out of breath, Kristoforovich asked the stenographer to read back my confession. He copied off parts of it on a sheet of paper, then underlined one sentence before reading it aloud. Doing the villainous bidding of wreckers and counter-revolutionaries. Those were your words. I wasn't sure where he was going with this and nodded tentatively. Which brings us to the core of the crime, Mandelstam. Who put you up to composing the epigram in the first place? Who ordered you to read it to as many people as possible in the hope that its poison would reverberate? He plucked another page from the dossier and read from it. Reverberate across the land like ripples from a pebble thrown into stagnant water. My mouth must have fallen open. Kristoforovich snickered with pleasure at my surprise. I presume you recognize your own words. As you will have guessed by now, the young woman pushing the child in a stroller behind you that day in Moscow was equipped with a directional microphone and recording everything you said. Comrade interrogator read the heading on the page. Transcript of conversation between Mandelstam, Pasternak, Akhmatova. Thursday the 12th of April 1934. Moscow Street. The party will declare a national holiday. The Komsomol will sing it. It
being your slanderous epigram, as they march off to fulfill their quotas. At congresses in the Bolshoi, from every balcony and box, workers will shout it out. It will be the end of Stalin. Clearly, only someone in the Bolshevik superstructure would be in a position to suggest to you how the party, how the Komsomol, how delegates to a congress in the Bolshoi theatre would react to the demise of Stalin. Was it Kamenev or Zinoviev, both of whom were expelled from the party as Trotskyists in 1927? Was it that slime Rykov, who has been plotting against Stalin since the death of Lenin? Perhaps it was the darling of the party, the great Bukharin, expelled from the Politburo because he sided with Stalin's enemies, who criticized revolutionary, as opposed to evolutionary, collectivization. There is, after all, a long history of Bukharin acting as your guardian angel. First to free your brother from prison, then arranging flats and ration cards, and a monthly pension for services to Russian literature, even organizing contracts for future volumes that were paid for but never published. The list of Bukharin's favors to you are as long as your arm. He pulled strings to get you travel permits to the Crimea. He used his influence to have several of your prose pieces published. He even offered you and your wife exit visas from Russia in the mid-20s, which, to your credit, you turned down. Pity. Perhaps you wouldn't be where you are today if you had gone into exile. Was it Bukharin who proposed you return all these favors by circulating a poem slandering Stalin? Or was it the arch-traitor Trotsky himself? Actually, the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced ripples on stagnant water sounds exactly like a formulation that would appeal to the twisted mind of the Jew Trotsky. We know for a fact that he has set industrial wreckers to throwing cut glass into sacks of farina. He has ordered mechanics to add water to aviation fuel. He has invited kulaks to slaughter their livestock rather than deliver the animals to collective farms. He is not above psychological wrecking, encouraging a gullible poet to spread poison about Stalin like ripples on stagnant water. No one put me up to it, I insisted. The idea for truth-telling originated with me. Surely you don't expect us to believe that. You're an intellectual. You don't have the profile of a counter-revolutionary. Kristoforovich glanced at another report in his dossier. You do remember what that girl said in the canteen for trolley car workers last January. Once, long ago, there was such a poet. Perhaps it was in the wake of this insult that someone whispered in your ear, as a poet, you have dropped below the literary horizon. If you circulate a slanderous poem about Stalin, your star will rise. You will be recognized as one of Russia's great poets. Who whispered in your ear? Who organized the conspiracy? The only thing that can save you is a confession. I didn't compose the poem to get attention. I am not part of a conspiracy. I am a poet, not a plotter. I wouldn't know how to function in a conspiracy. You have been manipulated, Mandelstam. Surely you can see that now. You must identify the person or persons who originated this counter-revolutionary scheme. Your confession, your naming names, is not worth the paper it's written on until you identify the instigators. He circled around behind me and began talking to the nape of my neck. Look at the trouble they caused you. You and your wife and your mistress. Pasternak, Akhmatova, all the others. The traitors who put you up to this don't give a shit about your fate. Why do you protect scum of the earth? You owe them nothing. Save yourself. Save Nadezhda and the others from a fate worse than death. Slow strangulation by hanging from short ropes. Simulated drowning in laundry basins. Suffocation in sealed cells. Standing naked for days on end in sub-zero temperatures. The breaking of bones in the body, one a day. Your cellmate Sergo's fate. Give me the name of the ringleader. Gathering what must have been the last shred of outrage in my trembling body, I said, you claim to be builders, but in the end you are only torturers. Comrade interrogator was mightily offended. My poor Mandelstam, we are not torturers. Czechist tradition holds that to be deemed torture, a procedure must shock the conscience. I thought I'd found the flaw in his logic. How can a procedure shock the conscience if you have no conscience? You make a grave miscalculation, Mandelstam. We Bolsheviks live by conscience. We are committed to the principle that ends justify means. As the end in question is the construction of communism,
Our conscience instructs us that all means, any means, are justified.